Hello, and welcome to the Science Podcast for September 29th, 2006. I'm Stuart Wills, the online editor of Science Magazine. In today's show, the focus is on genetics. We'll learn about how one research group is cataloging the connections among drugs, genes, and diseases. We'll also cast a genetic light on the evolution of that supremely complex organ, the eye, and talk with a young European scientist who's working on the frontiers of human genetics and disease. And we'll have our usual roundup of other stories from science and its news website, Science Now. So stick around. Kicking things off today, a genomic connectivity map. Since the publication of the human genome sequence half a decade ago, researchers and clinicians have become increasingly excited by the notion of targeting drugs to the genetic roots of diseases. But that problem is hardly a snap. The very wealth of data from the genome can sometimes obscure the real functional connections between diseases, genes, and molecular therapies. One group, led by Justin Lam and Todd Golub of the MIT-Harvard Broad Institute, is pursuing an ambitious effort to overcome those difficulties by creating an enormous catalog of cellular states. The goal? To tie the genome signatures of specific disease conditions with the signature of potential drug candidates. The first fruits of that effort are published in the September 29th issue of Science, and we're pleased to have Dr. Golub on the line to talk with us about them. Dr. Golub, welcome to the Science Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Now, Dr. Golub, this seems, to at least to an outsider in the field like myself, to be an enormous undertaking. Fundamentally, what's driving this?
Well, the sequencing of the human genome really, I think, opened all of our eyes about new ways to approach biology, to be able to think about biology in a systematic sort of way, and to be able to think about biology and disease as information. And so what I think might have previously seemed as a daunting task to systematically make signatures of disease and signatures of drugs is really perhaps not so daunting anymore, particularly as the cost of new technologies like DNA microarrays continues to fall.
And this whole effort ultimately revolves around building something called a connectivity map. Just what is a connectivity map?
Well, the concept here is that we want to try to develop a common language with which we can describe diseases, describe genes in the genome and their actions, and describe the action of drugs and other small molecules. By describing all of these states, cellular states, using a common language, we can then establish connectivity or relationships between these different states. And so here we chose the language of gene expression because one can generate gene expression profiles in high throughput and reasonable cost, making it possible to use this as a way to establish this connectivity.
So establishing connectivity by virtue of the way specific genes are expressed in proteins.
Exactly.
And in the paper you're publishing this week in Science, you report on, I guess, the first steps or first installments of this map. What areas did you focus on? I mean, obviously, there's a huge universe to choose from here.
Right. Well, I mean, at the beginning, it was clear there are many, many reasons why this concept might not work at all. So it was critical for the first series of experiments to make sure that we could see things in the data that we expected to find. So the initial focus was on recovering connections between drugs and diseases, for example, that we already knew about, because if we couldn't see those, it was probably time to stop. And so we focused around some classes of known drugs and then extended those to new classes of drugs to see whether we could discover new things.
So it's a proof of concept we're really talking about.
That's true.
Well, obviously, the details are pretty complex, but could you take us in kind of a general way through what you did here?
There are really three fundamental components to the connectivity map concept. The first is a query signature. The second is a database of systematically generated gene expression profiles. And the third are the analytical tools to make connections between the query signature and these reference profiles. We chose a specific strategy and a specific analytical strategy such that we wouldn't be locked into any particular technology platform to measure these signatures and profiles. figuring that in the future, the technology is likely to evolve, DNA microarrays are likely to evolve, and we wanted to have a system for establishing similarity between these query signatures and the reference profiles in the database that could keep up with changing technology.
And what were you able to do with these data?
Well, we were able to see connections, for example, between drugs of similar mechanism of action. For example, we could discover that multiple members of a class of drugs known as histone deacetylase inhibitors all share a common gene expression signature, indicating that if there was a new, perhaps structurally unrelated member of this class, one could recognize it by virtue of its signature. We were also able to discover new connections that were not previously anticipated. For example, we found connections between a class of natural products, small molecules extracted from medicinal plants, and the chaperone complex known as Hitchcock protein 90, whereas one could not have inferred that simply by looking at the structure of these chemicals. We could see the connection between these natural products, small molecules, and HSP90 by virtue of their common signatures.
So you were able to look both at drugs that are already known to work on certain conditions and infer from this kind of separate data stream how those drugs worked, but at the same time you were able to uncover some potential new pathways.
That's right.
So where does all this go from here?
Well, there's much that we still don't really understand about how the connectivity map might evolve over time, what its true potential may be, and also what its set of limitations are likely to be. But so far, the concept really appears to work. So our feeling is that the next phase of this project really needs to become a community effort whereby a connectivity map database is populated with a much larger variety of gene expression profiles, and access to this database needs to be made completely public so that the broader research community can explore the uses and potential limitations of the connectivity map going forward.
Well, Dr. Golub, it sounds like a huge undertaking, but a good start. Thanks very much for taking the time to talk with us about it today.
My pleasure.
Todd Golub is the author, with Justin Lamb and 18 other colleagues, of a new paper on using gene expression signatures to connect genes, diseases, and potential small molecule therapies. The paper appears in the September 29th issue of Science. Look for it online at science.sciencemag.org. Coming up in a moment, a glance at the evolution of the eye.
Did you know that AAAS members benefit from special access to a daily news service, weekly funding updates, monthly research roundups, and newsletters? Members also get discounts on books, travel, scientific events, including our annual meeting, workshops, seminars, and more. This in addition to 51 weekly issues of the premier journal Science. To join or renew, go to www.AAAS.org/membership. AAAS, advancing benefits for members.
What use is half an eye is a question famously posed by opponents of evolutionary theory to suggest that the structure of the eye is far too complex to have evolved by natural selection. But as new genetic and genomic studies are making clear, the eye, far from being an argument against evolution, is actually a superb example of evolution in action. Russell Fernald of Stanford University reviews how genetics is helping to tell the story of eye evolution in the September 29th issue of Science as part of a special section on genomic evolution. He's on the line with us now to talk a bit about eye evolution. Dr. Fernald, thanks for being with us.
Glad to be here.
One of the more striking statements in your review, at least to me, is that there are only a handful of basic eye types out there, 8 types of eyes in all. Could you give us a few examples of what you're talking about here?
Well, basically, eye types are limited by their optics as we see them now. So animals, for example, that live underwater, whether they're vertebrates or invertebrates, have similar eyes. They have a lens that collects the light and focuses it on some kind of photodetectors. And the lenses, for example, are very similar because these animals all live underwater. So they've been constrained by the evolutionary selection of a water-to-eye interface. Fruit flies and related insects that have eyes that have really many, many different separate photoreceptors, the faceted eyes that people are familiar with, each one pointed in a slightly different direction. And spiders have a chambered eye, not unlike ours, and they have 10 eyes around their head. So instead of having one eye that does many things, each one of their eye pairs does a slightly different thing. So there's a great variety of apparent eye types, but underlying them are just a limited number of optical solutions.
So there are so few eye types, basically, because of the physics of light?
Yes, light has specific physical properties that we know about. It travels in straight lines. It has a number of different wavelengths. It might be polarized, for example. And all these properties constrained the evolution of eyes. So, for example, the pupil or the aperture that light comes into in an eye can't be smaller than the wavelength of light or the eye won't work. Eyes need to collect it. They need to focus it on a photoreceptor surface and convert photons into information usable for the brain. And these constraints are just met by a very few number of optical structures. One is no lens. That's a pit eye. One is a refractive element. That's what we would think of as a lens. And it could be a spherical lens or a tiny lens in a compound eye. And the third kinds of eyes use mirrors for their optics. And those are scallops and lobsters, for example.
So this limited number of basic eye designs is an example of what's called convergent evolution, of perhaps unrelated animals settling on the same basic plan because, in a sense, that's what their environment told them to do.
Well, that's exactly right. If you think about fish and cephalopods or octopus, squid or octopus, for example, so they live underwater, and they need a very powerful lens to focus the light. So you'll know if you go swimming, you can't see underwater because much of the refractive power or the focusing power of our lens comes from the air-corneal interface because there's a difference in refractive index. They don't have that, so they have a really strong spherical lens. And the spherical lens wouldn't work. It would have spherical aberration. But using proteins, all the animals that live underwater have spherical lenses, and they've made gradients of refractive index to make them work. But fish, for example, make their lens from a single source, while octopus make it from two bits of tissue. These species evolved about 250 million years after their last common ancestor. So they came to these solutions independently. They converged on these.
So they have structurally similar solutions, but they're doing them in a different way.
Exactly.
As I mentioned at the outset, your article in Science looks especially at how the tools of genetics and genomics have given us new insight on how the eye evolved. What are some of those insights?
Well, what I just mentioned really is that there are two main components of eyes that you think about. One is collecting and focusing the light, and the other is detecting light. So focusing is done by the lenses, and these lenses are made of proteins that are so diverse, it's as if they were picked up at a garage sale somewhere. They're collected almost at random from other proteins used in the body. And in fact, these proteins can be used one place as an enzyme and another place in the lens, and one gene will encode them both, something that's discovered in lenses called lens sharing. But since lens evolved independently from the rest of the eye, and since they're made of many different things in many different organisms, and within a single lens, many proteins can be used, they haven't really helped us understand eye evolution. They arose sort of independently. And so that molecule, or the molecules that make up lenses, we've discovered now through genetics. Some are related, some aren't, but they don't have a lineage that lets us think about eye evolution.
But the light sensing mechanism does?
Right. So in the course of evolution, gene duplication resulted in many kinds of opsin, which is the molecule that really, in collaboration with a second molecule, is used for light collection in every animal. And in fact, genetics tells us that there are 7 of these opsin types in the human eye alone. So understanding their relationship has been really valuable for understanding evolution because there is a lineage that goes back to before then there were eyes. There were opsin molecules. And really, more importantly, we now know that there are at least 2 different opsin systems are at work in our eyes. They collaborate to give us the information we harvest from light.
Well, based on what you've just said, I think I know the answer to this, but historically there's been a debate over whether the eyes in various groups arose from a single origin or multiple times independently. What is all this genetic evidence telling us about that?
Well, I think it's very clear that photodetection in the form of molecule types that collect light arose probably many, many times. And two of those main lines of photodetection gave rise to eyes as we know them. And the evidence, as I said a minute ago, is really in our own eyes. We have the regular, well-known photodetection system in our rods and cones at the back of our eye. But in the inner retina, cells that people used to think were just processing that information are cells that also detect light. And these cells are really surprising. They use the mechanism for collecting and transferring photons into neural energy that's exactly the same as found in insects. So that means that there were two ancient photodetection systems in the evolutionary running for becoming the main pattern vision system, one based on one kind of opsin, one in vertebrates, and the other based in another kind of opsin, one in invertebrates. But it's, what genetics has taught us is that the competition didn't end with the loser being vanquished, but rather remaining to collaborate. So we have the residue of evolutionary competition really visible in our own eyes.
Dr. Fernald, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Russell Fernald is the author of Casting a Genetic Light on the Evolution of the Eye, a review published in the September 29th issue of Science. It's part of a special section on genomic evolution.
Did you know that AAAS members help plug the power of science into public policy? Since 1973, we've brought nearly 2,000 scientists and engineers to Washington, D.C. as science and technology policy fellows. They provide scientific analysis to policymakers in congressional offices and in federal agencies. Find out more at fellowships.AAAS.org. AAAS, advancing science careers, enhancing public policy.
Many young life scientists, empowered by the buried treasure of data embedded in the human genome, are finding new career opportunities in the fields of genetics and human health. One such scientist is Eleftheria Zaghini, the Wellcome Trust Research Career Development Fellow with the UK's Wellcome Trust Centre for Human Genetics. At age 29, Dr. Zaghini has already worked on projects involving diabetes and juvenile arthritis and is working toward building her own research group. She's one of three scientists profiled as part of a special feature on careers in human genetics on Science's online jobs and career development site, sciencecareers.org. We're delighted to have her on the line with us today to chat about her work and her experience building a career in the modern world of genetics. Dr. Zaghini, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Well, Dr. Zaghini, the sequence of the human genome was published a bit more than 5 years ago. What has that meant in the years since for research in human genetics and health?
Well, sequencing of the human genome has indeed had a major impact on the field of human genetics. It has provided us with a reference sequence and annotation of the genome. And in this way, it's enabled research into the underlying genetic causes of disease. And, of course, more recently, completion of the International HapMap project has meant that now we have available a common reference for single-base sequence variation.
And is this sort of wealth of new possibilities what got you interested in pursuing a research career in this field?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I trained in biochemistry, but through the genetics and the genomics modules of my undergraduate course at UMIST in Manchester, I developed a really big interest in the field. I then went on to gain some hands-on experience by working in a molecular biology lab over the summers, which is when I really started to appreciate the impact of the human genome sequencing project, which was back then underway, and the possibilities opening up, especially in relation to the understanding of the genetic causes of human disease. So that led me to the decision to then go on and undertake an arthritis research campaign studentship for my PhD at the ARC Epidemiology Unit in Manchester. And my doctoral studies focused on dissecting the immunogenetics of juvenile idiopathic arthritis, which is a complex autoimmune disease affecting children. And my PhD project involved laboratory-based generation of genotype data in order to fine map the major histocompatibility complex in juvenile arthritis, and then downstream statistical analysis of this generated genotype data in an association study setting.
So you essentially started out in the lab but kind of gravitated more toward, I guess, what's an area called statistical genetics. Is that correct?
That's correct. After having generated genotype data in the lab, I needed to analyze. And the ARC unit was very supportive in my development of those analytical skills. So I attended several dedicated courses. And this is actually when my interest in this field of statistical genetics started to grow more and more.
And what is statistical genetics? It sounds pretty far removed from the laboratory work you were doing before.
Indeed, working in statistical genetics means a lot of computer-based work. However, I do feel that it is important to have a good understanding of what goes on in the lab where all of these phenotype data are generated. Now, the particular area that I am focusing on in this field of statistical genetics is the development of strategies for the design, analysis, and interpretation of large-scale disease association studies, and, of course, their application in real data sets. Now, as part of Professor Mark McCarthy's group in Oxford for the past 2.5 years, I've had the opportunity to be involved in many large-scale type 2 diabetes association studies. So type 2 diabetes is a common disease and is caused by a complex interplay between genetic and environmental factors. My current research in statistical genetics, which is funded by the Wellcome Trust in the form of a research career development fellowship, focuses on crucial aspects of study design, analysis, and interpretation. And by hopefully gaining an improved understanding of these issues, we can start to ensure maximum output from the substantial financial investments associated with these endeavors.
One thing that you said earlier, you said that you felt that your research was becoming more mathematical, but at the same time it was important for you to have the lab background. I've sort of gotten the impression that there's a lot of different people of different backgrounds coming into the field of genetics now based on the fact that it is becoming more computational. Could you just comment on that based on your own experience?
Yes, absolutely. The field is not just for biologists anymore. In fact, the field of statistical genetics boasts a constellation of brilliant scientists from diverse backgrounds, including mathematics, computer science, chemistry, and physics. For example, at the Wellcome Trust Center for Human Genetics, where I am based, many of my colleagues and collaborators come from non-life science backgrounds.
That brings up kind of an interesting point because, I mean, you pursued kind of a, I guess, traditional biological education, but based on your own experience, what advice would you offer to someone at the undergraduate level who's interested in a career in this field in terms of preparation?
Well, the field has recently witnessed some major advances and continues to progress rapidly. As we mentioned before, scientists from many different backgrounds can excel in the field of statistical genetics, but it is important to keep abreast of all the latest developments, both genetic and analytical. And now, in my experience, one of the most important aspects of building a career in statistical genetics has to be the choice of research group, both for doctoral studies and for postdoctoral work. I do feel it is important to work in an environment that fosters fruitful ideas exchange and offers a wide expertise base from which to draw and provides a large network of collaborators to expand as well.
So the choice of a research group is crucial. What are the next steps in your own career? I mean, I understand you're trying to build a sort of a research group of your own.
Absolutely, yes. I'm fortunate to have recently been awarded a Wellcome Trust Research Career Development Fellowship under the sponsorship of Professors Lon Cardon and Mark McCarthy. I to stay here at the Wellcome Trust Center for Human Genetics in Oxford. And this provides me with the opportunity to focus on the exciting methodological aspects of large-scale genetic association studies and gives me the chance to start building my own group and to establish myself really as an independent researcher in the field of statistical genetics. And these are my main goals over the next 4 years.
Well, it sounds like an exciting time both in your life and in genetics generally. Dr. Zaghini, thanks very much for taking the time to chat with us about it today.
Thank you.
Eleftheria Zaghini works on statistical genetics with the Wellcome Trust Center for Human Genetics at the University of Oxford. She's one of several scientists profiled in a special feature on careers in human genetics on Science's jobs and career development site, sciencecareers.org. Here are a few other items of interest from Science this week outside of the world of genetics. In the journal's monthly education forum, psychologists Angeline Lillard and Nicole Elsick-West assess the effectiveness of Montessori education. First used with impoverished preschoolers in Rome a century ago, Montessori schools remain popular today. It's estimated that there are more than 5,000 of them in the U.S. alone. Montessori schools have some fundamental differences from traditional schools. These differences include multi-age classrooms, special educational materials, an emphasis on collaboration, an absence of grades and tests, and instruction in social as well as academic skills. In their study comparing Montessori students with a control group, Lillard and Elsick-West found that the academic and social scores of the Montessori students were equal or superior to those in other types of schools. Meanwhile, in the world of cancer therapy, a team of 15 researchers led by Jérôme Galland and Franck Paget examined the diagnosis of colorectal cancer in human patients. Studying three large patient cohorts, the team looked in particular at patient immune cells infiltrating the tumor and found that the type, density, and location of the immune cells were a better predictor of overall patient survival than the histopathology of the tumor itself. This human study supports earlier work in mice, suggesting that the immune system can recognize tumors and help control their growth. And the results suggest that getting information about the immune response in individual cases could be a useful tool in colorectal cancer prognosis and in tailoring treatments to specific patients. Well, finally today, David Grimm, the editor of Science's free daily news site, Science Now, is back with us once again to give us a look at some other recent stories. David, welcome back to the studio.
Thanks for having me back.
Okay, David, what's the story today?
Well, we've got three stories, very cool as always. I can talk to you about a cricket that may be evolving itself out of existence, tell you what's going on in your brain when you feel like somebody's following you. And finally, I will tell you that your musical taste may say more about you than you even think it does.
Well, that's rather worrisome to me, but let's start with these unfortunate insects.
Right. So there's a group of insects in Hawaii called the black field cricket. And actually, they're not native to Hawaii. They come from Fiji, Tahiti, and Australia. But at some point, probably over the last few hundred years, they made their way to Hawaii. And when they did, they met another invasive species there. It's a parasitic fly that's native to North America. And the fly got really excited when this cricket came because the crickets make cricket noises when they're mating. The males rub their grooved wings together, and it makes the sounds you associate with crickets, and that's how they found a mate. Well, unfortunately, the fly quickly learned that's how you find a cricket. And so they started attacking these male crickets whenever they made their noise. And over the past 20 years or so, a team of researchers have noticed that the crickets were growing quieter and quieter and quieter every year they studied them. And at first they thought, well, maybe it's just because the crickets are dying out because these flies are being, you know, really aggressive in terms of hunting them. But it turns out that the crickets have evolved over a relatively short time span to ungroove their wings. Their wings are flat. The researchers call them flat wings. And now they don't make any noise anymore. So they don't make any noise and the flies can't find them anymore.
Well, if the flies can't find them, though, how can their mates find them?
That's exactly the problem. So their mates can't find them either. And this could pose a real problem for the crickets because if they can't make noise, they can't get females. So the researchers are trying to figure out how they might deal with this. And what they did is they set out these empty patches of land on a few islands in Hawaii, and they put speakers on these patches, and the speakers basically blasted the sound of a normal male cricket call. And what they found is that on the islands where the flies weren't really a problem, the male crickets just sort of ignored these patches of land. They didn't go near the speakers or anything. But on the one island where the flies were a big problem, they noticed that the flat wings were getting close to these speakers and actually hanging out near these speakers where they heard the normal male call.
So the flat wings kind of knew where the women were going to be.
Right. So they figure that in nature, the flat wings are going to where the guys that are making the sounds are because that's where the women are going to be attracted to. And once the women come, them, these flatwings can intercept and still mate. But the researchers are still concerned because obviously this isn't a situation that can go on like this forever. As the
sooner or later, those other crickets are going to lose their chirps too.
Exactly. And when that happens, it's possible that the crickets are going to die off because they can't find a mate. And the flies could actually die off too if they become very dependent on the crickets. So this could be a real bad news for both species.
And now the shadow people.
The shadow people, right? Well, Stuart, have you ever had the feeling when you're walking down the street, you think somebody might be following you?
All the time,
right.
Actually.
And nobody's there, right? So what's going on? So researchers think they may have figured it out, and it comes from a really interesting test case of this 23-year-old woman who was suffering epileptic seizures. So the researchers started probing around her brain and trying to figure out what was going on. They were stimulating various parts of her brain, and all of a sudden they stimulated this region called it's called the left temporoparietal junction, or the TPJ, the left TPJ. And as soon as they did this, she all of a sudden felt another person in this room, a person she described as a shadow person. When she stood up, he stood behind her. When she sat down, he sat down behind her.
Hmm.
And actually, when they tried
spooky.
It was sort of spooky. And when they tried to give her a test involving test cards, the shadow person tried to take a test card away from her. And the researchers thought this was really interesting because in patients with schizophrenia often believe that there's somebody else in the room or somebody else is controlling their actions. So they wonder whether in some neurologic disorders there's a problem with this TPJ. And they're still not exactly sure what the TPJ does, but they think, you know, when your brain is sort of deciding, you know, interpreting all the cues that we feel in everyday life, it sort of has to remind your body all the time that, you know, you're one body and you're dealing with all these sensory cues. And they think if the TPJ gets messed up, that the brain sort of loses its perspective and starts thinking there's other bodies in the room dealing with these cues.
So it kind of controls your sense of self.
Exactly, your sense of self. So this study could provide sort of important insight into our sense of self and also what may be going wrong in disorders such as schizophrenia, and also maybe people who feel like they may have been abducted by aliens who also sometimes think there's other people in the room or other people are controlling their actions.
Okay, and finally, what our musical tastes tell about us. I'm a little worried about this one.
Right. Well, it's not politically correct, but I think it's fair to say that sometimes people judge other people based on the music they listen to. You know, you hear somebody listening to classical music and maybe you assume they're highly educated, and you hear some guy driving down the street blasting rap music or country music, and maybe you don't think as highly of them. But a new research study suggests that these perceptions, these stereotypes, may actually hold some water. A team from the UK gave 2,000 people a survey, which they were asked to talk about their musical styles they listened to, but also talk about their behaviors, their income, their education, and things like that. And the results conformed pretty well to stereotypes. For example, about 8.5% of the people that listen to classical music have PhDs versus only about 1.4% of the people who favor disco music. And classical music lovers also seem to make more money. Their average income was about $66,000 versus about $44,000 for people that like dance music. And finally, classical music people were inclined towards more quote-unquote intellectual fare. They read current affairs magazines, whereas people that liked rap or pop tended to favor magazines about celebrities or cars or women and things like that. Another interesting pattern was this, what the researchers called a clustering of antisocial tendencies among people that favor pop, rap, and rock.
What are antisocial tendencies?
So things like, you know, admitting to having committed a crime.
Oh, I see.
So 53% of hip-hop fans admitted to having committed a criminal act compared to 18% of fans of musicals.
Well, there's one thing I like here, though, about opera buffs.
Right. Not all of these made sense. Not all these correlations made sense. For example, the researchers found that opera buffs were the least likely of all the groups to take showers or to wash their hair, whereas people that like DJ-based music, like dance music, were the most frequent shampooers. So some sort of unusual findings here. It's not all stereotypes, but it definitely does show that if you see somebody listening to classical music and you maybe think positive thoughts about them and negative thoughts about somebody else, that if at least with this study, the science seems to back you up a little bit.
Okay, well, first thing I'm doing tonight is checking my record collection. David, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the free online daily news service of Science. You can catch up with these and other stories on the site at sciencenow.sciencemag.org. And that wraps up the September 29, 2006 Science Podcast. The show is a production of Science Magazine and of AAAS, the Science Society, with additional financial support from the Golden Fund. The content is provided by the news and editorial staff of Science. Jeffrey Cook composed the music for the podcast, and our producer is Barnaby Bristol. I'm Stuart Wills, the online editor of Science. On behalf of the journal and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.